There's a jumble of trophies lying on the gym floor. They've tumbled mostly toward the poet, who leans on his elbow, holding one of the loving cups in his left hand, looking at its silver-plated side as if in a mirror. The image asks us what he beholds. It's part of the arresting cover design for a new collection of poetry by Thomas Kielty Blomain, titled Yellow Trophies, whose pages often invoke the images of trophies. Read a trophy poem for us.
Trophy of old age. The mirror, a display case for your trophy. Your face, changed with each yellow reward. Not for heroics necessarily, nor for conquests or victories, but merely for making it here. Where you gaze at the lines your seasons recorded in deep creases, your eyes and teeth, the skin of your cheeks, the uncertainty of your lips. All hold those weary stories. Your tongue longs to tell someone of the good things you have done. But even you don't want to listen to yourself anymore, your empty and unconvincing words. At last you might look away once you formalize a truce and are able to make yourself believe your phases have been the finest awards you've won and how your losses ultimately become you. You can release yourself from your broken smile now and settle for an awkward peace, because it seems you've at last attained an age you never dreamed of and worn yourself out fairly well.
Poet Thomas Kielty Blomain reading a poem titled Trophy of Old Age from his new collection titled Yellow Trophies, issued by New York Quarterly Books. Blomain has another poem titled For the Professor Who Neglected Hart Crane in this book, celebrating the power of the late Hart Crane's poetry, and in fact, he's chosen an epigraph for Yellow Trophies from Hart Crane's elegy, Praise for an Urn, that reads, Scatter these well-meant idioms into the smoky spring that fills the suburbs, where they will be lost. There are no trophies of the sun. Writing about Crane in the study Hart Crane's poetry, John Irwin reminds us the urn of that title, holding the ashes of Ernest Nelson, Hart Crane's friend, would be shaped characteristically like a vase with a lid, resembling the kind of loving cup often given as a trophy for victory. And also that the word trophy ultimately derives from the Greek word tropei, meaning turning, flight, defeat, and its original meaning was anything taken in war, especially when preserved as a memento, a spoil, or a prize. But the Greek word tropei is also the root of the word trope in English, a poetic figure of speech or turn of phrase, leading us to ask whether the trophy-like urn of the friend's ashes might be seen as both a memento of an individual life's defeat in death and the victory, the persistence of life itself. And is there a role for poetry to play? As it happens, we've just heard in Blomain's poem about each yellow reward, not for heroics necessarily, nor for conquests or victories, but merely for making it here. And that, of course, is the persistence of life. And as Hart Crane writes of the smoky spring that fills the suburbs where poetic images will be scattered and lost, the old man who has the last word in Blomain's collection blows smoke in the speaker's face and ours too, leaving us with a smirk, a gleam in his eye, and the wisdom of putting it all into perspective. Thomas Kielty Blomain will read from Yellow Trophies tomorrow evening at the AFA Gallery in Scranton, and again the following Friday, November 4th, at the Waverly Community House. Tom Blomain stopped in at the WVIA studios to talk with us about Yellow Trophies and the way we're drawn in by the distinctive cover images.
My friend Mark McGlory of Electric City Television took a photograph of himself, and he and I were standing on the street, and this was a shadow picture taken and manipulated. And I happened to just be thinking of a cover, and Ray saw this picture, and he said, that's your cover, because he had read the book, and it seems to represent... It's kind of a frightening solitariness that exists, that we all share, I think. And the title itself, Yellow Trophies, kind of is intended to represent all the things we go through in life for which there are no awards. And that's the image on the back, also taken by my friend Mark McGlory, replicating, let's say, a gymnasium floor and the trophies. And the looking back on the things in life that you don't get trophies for. That's what the book kind of is about.
There are many themes like that and variations on the theme, but each time we might encounter a mirror or a face in the mirror, it's a little bit different. The context is a little bit different. The exploration is deeper or skewed or in a way that circles round. And that's the musical element in this, and you have a sense of that kind of rhythm as well. There are sections in the book as well that you title myths and heirlooms,
right,
and so forth. Did you have all these poems and then you thought, well, they'll make a book, or how did this come to be?
They seem to almost assess themselves in a way, and that's where I came up with the titles, the theories, myths, heirlooms, and apologies. The sections sort of came to me, and then I thought, these are theories, these are myths, these are heirlooms, and these are apologies. And then it tied together with the yellow trophies, the things that really you may or may not have actual physical awards for or something to document in your life, but carry with you and actually are more important than a trophy. And I talk specifically in some poems about trophies, awards, things on shelves, crowded shelf, empty shelf, that sort of thing.
This is not a young person's book. When we first met
30 years ago,
you wouldn't have written this book at that point.
No.
This is a person,
right,
who has a certain maturity and wisdom.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, yes. Actually, there are a couple poems in here that I did write back then. Shooting Mary is one. And I agonized over including that because it's potentially controversial, but in a way it's intended to be funny, but serious. And the other is A Bone to Pick, also, you know, both kind of bordering on a little bit of religious iconoclasm, which I do anyway in my ordinary life. But those are two of the oldest poems, and those I did write back in the day and just brought them out to put them in here, maybe to aggravate people, which I like to do with poetry. But poetry should certainly, I think, a successful poem causes some sort of reaction. The worst thing is to hear somebody read a poem and go, oh, that's nice, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'd rather have someone fire the book across the room and, you know, call me names than to just let it happen that way. So my poems tend to either be a punch in the gut or a slap in the head or a stomp on the foot in some way.
And there is a sense of mortality, literally saying goodbye to a friend, for example.
A few of those.
And poems for your sister. Also just the fact of looking in the mirror and seeing wrinkles.
Right.
But even if you are an iconoclast in terms of religion particularly, these are incarnational poems. You're really rooted in place and our physical bodies.
Absolutely. And that's a really great way to put it, so thank you for that.
Take us before the mirror in one of the poems and talk to us about that reflection.
Yeah, that particular one, ending this, and also my previous book, Blues from Paradise, the last poem in that, The Man in the Mirror. And in Gray Area, my first book, there's in an elevator the reflection in the tin. I think like everyone, whether we admit it or not, we look at ourselves. And, you know, over time, you start to look at yourself differently, and you have to be more accepting of the things time does to you and make fun of it, which the poem in this book kind of does more than anything else. I mean, it's a serious thing. We're facing mortality. We're looking at these changes. You know, maybe I was once beautiful. I'm not so much anymore. But in a way, I still am. And then the old man in the mirror kind of is a... It's a serious but whimsical poke at that we all do. And it also talks about the old man smoking a cigar. As you know, I was a huge cigar fan for many years. Stopped smoking in March. I haven't had one. And still going crazy over that, but have not had one. So my cigar smoking poems are probably past now.
It's a wonderful poem because of the way you are talking to yourself, the conversation that you're having.
Well, all of my poems are me talking to myself. I know that's probably not common. A lot of poetry that's very impersonal, I mean, academic and impersonal poetry that's highly favored. My poetry is deeply personal, and whimsical in the sense that, not that it isn't serious, but it's me talking to myself about subjects that occur to me, and they occur in this linguistic fashion, and I write them down. I want them to be personal. I want the subject matter and the way that I address the subject matter to come across as deeply personal. Not necessarily confessional, although some of them border on that.
The other thing, though, in that regard, then, Tom, is that we get a sense that despite it all, and the losses and the pains and the hurts and what we've done to other people and what they've done to us, we do make it through. And if we do, part of the way we survive or the way we make sense of our lives is the humor.
I am a very optimistic pessimist. It's kind of how I would describe myself. I do let things slide, look at the humorous side of things to the degree that I can. I'm as aggravated as anybody is about things, maybe sometimes more so, but, you know, I think I have like 14 different personalities. Sometimes I think, you know, which one of me is talking right now? I don't always know, and don't care as long as that person's either funny or musical or bringing something to the table.
In speaking of music, you are a writer of songs. You play guitar, you sing, and you did a little test for us to get the mic level, and you read to us a poem about a funeral and a church and an organ. Would you bring that out for us?
Sure.
The music and the organ in this is not just what happened in the church during the funeral.
Right, and I mean, around here, I mean, a lot of my poems, most of them in some way are affected by the area. I'm kind of a place poet in our region. Those of us who have lived here know how many churches there are on every corner. And this particular one is a true story. My Aunt Fran, who died, and I went to her funeral, and this is the funeral of Aunt Fran. The arches of stained glass torch magnificent streaks of orange across the ceaseless Jesus. And the small crowd gathered here in this Baroque cathedral for the funeral of Aunt Fran. The vast organ in the loft wails through huge golden pipes the closing of her beauty salon after 50 years doing hair. The chanting priest swings a smoking canister until the air is ruined and they roll her coffin out. Doubtless in her ancient vows to the ubiquitous church, this one hidden on a corner in Southside, and to my crazy uncle she wed long ago, whose own father hated the Pope and all the rest of the Church of Rome. Yet even he would have to marvel at this, the slashes of light across glass shards of saints all in a row on the bone-drilling pain of that instrument's sustained notes, whose voice, it seems, is neither choked by the gray billows of incense nor relieved by the ceremonial glory of this most ordinary death.
In that poem, you've got touch, you've got smell, you've got sound, the color, the glory, and her beauty salon.
Right. And tying, I mean, he was my uncle on my mother's side, and my uncle literally was crazy, institutionalized, and Fran had been doubtless in her vows to him. So that's, you know, very personal. Probably I'm saying it on the radio, but so everybody will know it now. But, you know, if you read this poem and didn't know that, it may not make a difference, I hope. But that's reflecting back to the personal nature of the poetry I talk about. There's generally some element of my personal life in some of these poems, all of them, somewhere along the way.
As it happens in recent months, the national conversation has included considerations of taking responsibility for our actions and thoughts, and also the capacity for asking for forgiveness.
Yeah, that's, well, and that ties in largely with the notion of what, you know, yellow trophies, what that means to me is, you know, we all have regrets. Somebody who says he has no regrets is lying. Period. I mean, we all do. And part of the maturation process, I think, is learning how to live properly with the regrets that you have and carry forward from things you did. And that is, you know, a big part of the thematic thread through this book and maybe through other works of mine as well. Whether it's, you know, I need serious forgiveness, you may or may not get it. You may not even seek it. And that's, I think, even one of the lines in this book. I'm not asking for forgiveness, but just saying, you know, these are the things I feel now. I kind of feel bad about some of the things I did back then. And that's part of that theme, coming to to grips with the things that you rue. And again, like poetry or some other avenue of expression is very important to that, to get it out, or else you'll find some more negative way to live with it. So fortunately, I have poetry and music, and that's kind of a good thing.
And you talked about poetry of place, and we do meet Scranton in many guises here. Is Scranton alive to you as a character in a certain way?
It is, and you're the first person who ever actually put it that way, but yes, I would say that kind of is true. And I do look at it that way, and you know, I am a Scranton guy, and I love it, and I always will be, with all of its negatives, and as my poems in here, Grail specifically talks about Scranton, the problems, and the political problems that we've always had here. But there is something in my blood about it, and I think I share that with a lot of people. People who are not poets who read or hear me read some of these things come up later and have said, well, you know, I felt that way. You know, you have a pride in Scranton, almost undeservedly so. And not just Scranton, I mean our whole region. I mean, I read in Wilkes-Barre a couple weeks ago, and very similar, obviously, city, and there's corollaries. But in the anthology, there's specifically the metaphor of an old man is an exact personification of the city of Scranton. If you'd like me to read it,
yes,
I will.
Yes, would you? Mm-hmm.
Sure. Metaphor of an old man. The side streets in Scranton tell the best stories. The little courts and alleys between avenues, where the tilted houses help hold each other up. Their rambling narrative like an old man who sits in a folding chair on a chipped paint porch, full of long pauses. At dusk, when the city drips from the sky's gray palette, there are the hands of someone who has touched it all, someone touched by everything but the one thing that remains unsaid at each sentence's end. I've pulled up beside him on 1,000 worn seats, leaned in to bring my ear close to his pursed lips, almost rasped by the coarse whiskers of his cheeks, waiting to hear his final admission of despair. But it never comes. Instead, he laughs loudly, gruffly, leaning back, not caring one bit about who laughs with him. When he points something out, you can tell by the knuckles he's worked hard, and the words he uses to explain how he came to be precisely where he is today fail to portray any notion of remorse. Of course, he wishes he had more money, but he quickly shrugs that demon away. As night falls, the lone lamppost out front bestows a halo over the cramped neighborhood. He blesses himself unconsciously, more in defiance than subservience, hearing an ambulance go by. As the siren gets louder, the closer it comes, he remembers some of the wild times he's had and breaks into a vast, crooked smile.
You've brought it all together, haven't you? It's alive. We're talking in terms of generations, and that's something you deal with here, too.
Like many people around here, I mean, we have a really interesting ethnicity in this area, and of course that's always changing, too, but from my perspective, my grandparents were each of a different nationality, all similar, Swedish, Welsh, Irish, and German. So they say I'm a Swig. That's where they come from. And I do talk about that in the book in a couple poems about the genealogy. They all came from different areas. They came, some were in the mines, my one great-grandfather in the Civil War, you know, from Ireland, all that. And Pockets of Immigrants, that's a poem in here too about the Irish immigrants.
And there's that trophy that is the chalice on the shelf that could symbolize for any family those stories that we tell about where we came from.
Right, the silver chalice, I call it. It is. It is a memento that kind of one of those yellow trophies. Really, it doesn't mean much to me other than being handed down, being old, and the stories that go with it, whether they're true or not, I don't know. But it is a yellow trophy. It's one of the reasons I came up with the title, I think.
Because of that real object.
Yeah, looking at that and thinking, oh, you know, it's tarnished, kind of yellowed. And the word yellow has all kinds of connotations, right?
Yellowed with age, a certain lack of courage sometimes.
Exactly, exactly, that you hit on that. And, you know, color is an important thing to me. It's a device that I like to use. In fact, the titles of my books all have some reflection on color, and the next one will as well. Because, you know, the visual nature of it and what it strikes you as, and it all means something. Gray, blues, yellow, and the next red.
Why don't you read The Silver Chalice?
The Silver Chalice. The Silver Chalice, as far back as I can remember, stood on top of the curio cabinet my parents had in the living room, ornate and engraved with the initials of my great-grandfather, a gift from the king is how the story goes, brought here, no one knows when, from the ebbing glory of the Swedish kingdom, advised never to try to clean it for fear of tainting a different kind of value than what it truly provides. It stands now on a shelf in our house in Scranton, tarnished like everything else, however grand from history. As a child, I imagined an epochal ceremony, an ermine-cloaked monarch with a golden crown bequeathing it upon my ancestor who modestly bowed to accept it. 1,000 years from the Viking Age, still I envisioned a hero who sailed to America in a dragon boat wrapped in fur and armed with a sword. But really, he was just a scientist who invented a powder to blow things up and left behind this storied cup to adorn the lineage of homes we've occupied ever since, reminding us, whenever we bother to look at it, that any imagined lore is inevitably contrived to be heroic and glamorous and may even incent us toward a mythic existence, more useful in this universe than whatever the actual reality was of our forefathers' forgotten lives.
So we do need that larger context.
I don't know if everyone does, but somehow for me it definitely is a connection. You know, I always think of my Swedish ancestors. As a kid, I was like, oh, they were Vikings, you know, they came over on these boats. And even when I was a kid, I used to think that, like, they came from Sweden, they were Vikings, and that's just part of the story. And I've always gotten a kick out of that as a kid, thinking that. But he was actually a scientist, and he did invent an explosive powder, my great-grandfather. So that part of the story is true. He had a patent on something called Jovite powder that was an explosive. And he was a very famous scientist connected with the Royal Swedish Academy and taught at Columbia University, I guess. And obviously I didn't know him, but that was his contribution to the world, something to blow things up. It's kind of what I like to think with my poetry. I blow things up, right? You blow up the way you think about something. And if that happens, then my poem is successful.
You clear a space and break us out of our old, moldy ways of thinking.
Hopefully that's true, yeah. A poem should sing on its own, I think. Even if it's not lyrical, it should still sound like a song of its own. But poetry brings us to a place in a very short space where we could not go otherwise, which is what I love. I have a great shelf of poetry at my house, bookcase, and I will almost every day pull out at least one randomly and open it to a random page and read a poem. So I go somewhere for a little while that I never would have thought to go before, and there's nothing else than poetry that can do that for us. And I think everybody should do that more. So, the importance of poetry in our culture, it's been terribly minimized, and unfortunately I think we poets might have the most to do with that, you know, turning it over, making it seem like an academic exercise and enterprise, where really it should be, you know, like it's a street thing. Poetry is like an everyday thing, not an ivory tower thing. And that's the way I come at it. Once I was stopped on the street by someone who saw a televised reading of mine. Never met him before, and he was like a painter, I guess. He said, that was a really cool thing you did. I said, really? Oh, you're a poetry fan? He goes, no, I don't care about poetry at all, but it was really cool what you did. And that, to me, was one of the best compliments I ever got. And it wasn't poetry as far as he was concerned. It was something else, and he really liked it. So it was kind of a, you know, smoke and mirrors to get people to like your poetry. To me, that experience was a yellow trophy. That meant very much to me as a poet, more than anything else I've heard from, you know, people, PhDs, English professors, whatever, this and that. Just some random guy covered with paint, I'll never forget it. So I don't like poetry, but I liked what you did.
Thomas Kielty Blomain of Scranton speaking with us about and reading from his new collection, Yellow Trophies, just issued by New York Quarterly Books. Blomain will read from Yellow Trophies tomorrow evening, Friday, that's Friday, at the AFA Gallery in Scranton at 7, and again the following Friday, November 4th, at the Waverly Community House, also at 7. For more information, on the web, nyq.org, and that's for New York Quarterly Books, an imprint of the New York Quarterly Foundation. We spoke with enthusiasm about the cover design, and the cover design is by Raymond P. Hammond. For more information, on the web, nyq.org, nyq.org. That's Thomas Kielty Blomain of Scranton. Yellow Trophies is the brand new collection, and you can hear him read from Yellow Trophies tomorrow evening, that's October 28th, at 7 in the evening at the AFA Gallery, 514 Lackawanna Avenue in Scranton, and then again the following Friday at 7 at the Waverly Community House in Waverly. For more information, on the web, nyq.org.